Now, adjust the volume control so that the sound can be heard in all parts of the room.
This is the Protect Your Assets podcast.
You get the idea? Bring me
a dream. It's on the internet. Make him the cutest
that I've ever seen. Go on. Give him two
lips. Like it's like no cheese I've ever tasted. And tell him
that his loss. Here's the Sandman.
Are you thinking of buying an electric vehicle? Well, if you are, then you definitely want to listen to our show this morning as we talk about natural gas, oil, and yes, electric vehicles. Good morning. Welcome to Protect Your Assets. I'm David Hollander, your host. It's so great to be with you on this crisp, clear, beautiful Bay Area morning. For those of you just joining us for the first time, welcome. People around here, they call me the Sandman, and that's because I help my listeners sleep well at night by answering their most troubled legal or financial questions. And that's because I am a financial advisor and a licensed attorney. So we have a tremendous show for you today. I have two special guests with me today. We're going to be talking about electric vehicles, power usage in the U.S., natural gas. Now, let's get started. Well, markets this week staged a rally. Dow was up 4. S&P was up 3.8%. NASDAQ up 3.6%. The 10-year Treasury staying down around 1.48%, and oil, $71.94 a barrel. So we saw a shift this week in a couple areas that were unknown, and so the markets like that, and this provided some clarity, which let the markets run a little bit. So first, we had the government get their act together and have no shutdown, so that was good. And then second, there's no debt ceiling drama that's going to happen either. So those two things are now behind us. But don't forget, they're still negotiating that spending bill. And if it passes, what we do see is that there's not going to be any raise in the personal or corporate income tax rate. So that, again, stocks like to see. We still don't know what the Fed's going to do, because this past week, Jerome Powell tend to shifted. And now he's saying that inflation is no longer transitory, and that the likelihood of them raising interest rates, which they haven't done in almost two years, now is a question of when. So I would expect markets to be more volatile going into 2022, which is not too far away. And so just look out for that. Overall, the economy is still doing pretty well. We had initial jobless claims come out on Thursday. The number was 184,000. That's the lowest number we've seen in 52 years. So again, that was pretty strong. Again, remember, that's somewhat seasonally adjusted because you're in the holiday season right now. And as you know, a lot of people get hired part-time to do work when all of us go shopping. So these are some things that are looking pretty good. Also, the inflation reading came out on Friday yesterday, the CPI number, 6.8%. That's the highest level we've seen since 1982. And inflation year over year was at 4.9%. So, you know, as we're going to be talking about oil today and the price of oil, certainly power that's necessary to keep us all doing what we need to do, you got to wonder how interest rates will phase into that as well, and how quickly interest rates will rise depending on what the Fed does. And so a lot of you asked me about the gold market, again, another commodity. I'll just get that out of the way. If rates rise quickly, like I've been talking about, again, I'm expecting the 10-year to get to around 2% first quarter next year, then gold is at risk. It's at risk of a correction, because right now the support for gold is lying at around $1,700 an ounce. But if that path is broken, then gold could go to $1,500 an ounce. So for those of you owning gold right now, thinking about buying it, you might want to be a little bit careful, because interest rates could affect that position if that's something you're going to do. All right. Well, this morning I have two guests with me. First, Dave Anderson, who is a former energy analyst and portfolio manager in the oil and gas space. And then John Samuels, who's CFO and CEO of an energy company, was. These guys know all about what we're going to be talking about today. So good morning, David. How are you?
Good morning, David. I'm fine. Great to be here.
Thank you. Thanks for coming in. So let's talk about electric vehicles. I hear this all the time. Look, you know, oil's going away. We don't need oil because everyone's going to be buying a Tesla and driving around, maybe even Vivian or whatever the heck they call it, Rivian. I don't know what they call it. But, you know, there's so many cars now around and you say, well, it's over. There's no more oil anymore. What do you think about that?
Well, that's definitely a function of you living in Northern California, where right. We do see a lot of electric vehicles, and I drive one myself. But we have to remember, the total number of cars on U.S. roads today is roughly 280 million. It's a lot of cars on the road.
It's a lot, yeah.
We sell about 15 to 16 million new cars every year, right? That's about 5% of the stock of cars that gets replaced every year.
Right.
So even if you said every single car was going to be an EV, 15 million cars a year, it would still take you 15 to 20 years to fully replace all the gasoline or the internal combustion ICE cars on the road today. So, you know, under 2% of the cars in the U.S. right now are pure EVs. I know it doesn't feel that way when you're looking for a parking spot down at Whole Foods and everything seems to be a Tesla.
Right.
But, you know, over the last couple of years, EV sales have ranged anywhere from 20,000 to 50,000 units a month. Now, if 2022 is a blockbuster year, best year ever,
yeah,
we might see 700,000 to 800,000 EVs sold in the U.S.
Still very, it's a percentage, but it's not a big percentage of the overall market, right? I mean, that's just the reality of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's about 5% of sales. Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the forecast suggests, I mean, the most optimistic forecast might say, look, we can probably get to 5 million a year by 2030, 8 years from now. And in the middle of those forecast ranges, probably more like 2.5-3 million. But if you could get to 5 million a year, by 2030, by that point, cumulatively, you would have replaced roughly 25 million cars in the U.S. And that's, you know, 25 million out of 280, still, you know, less than 10% of the cars on the road. And that's an optimistic forecast.
Right. And that assumes, too, that you've got manufacturers that can produce that kind of volume of cars. It doesn't seem right now that, you know, if you're ordering a Tesla right now online, you can go online and order it and you might get it next June, but right? I mean, there's a whole nother delivery aspect of getting this many cars. And sure, you got Volkswagen stepping into it. Audi's making cars now. Seems like Mercedes is getting there. Porsche is getting there. But these cars aren't cheap.
Well, they're not, and a lot of the manufacturers are, you know, trying to work down the cost scale. And there are a number of cars coming out in the next couple of years that are going to be a little bit more accessible. But at the same time, you have to build them. And, you know, the infrastructure isn't there yet. You know, we can talk about, you know, batteries and all the components of that, whether it's, you know, lithium or other aspects of the battery manufacturing facilities. But, you know, we would have to build a lot of battery facilities to get to more than what we're already talking about. Even getting to this 25 million cars cumulatively looks to be a massive infrastructure build out in the U.S.
So what I hear you saying, just kind of reading through all this is not going to happen in the next 3 to 4 years where electric cars are going to be taking over the entire car space in the U.S.
Right. And going back to your first question, you know, people say, well, crude oil is going away. Well, you know, not certainly in the next 10 years and yeah, probably not in the next 30 years. Certainly not completely. If you look at the, you know, this 25 million potential cars on the road, if you replace those 25 million cars, what does it do to crude oil demand? Well, I mean, you're talking about roughly 8 to 10% of the cars in the U.S., so you would certainly expect crude oil demand to be less than that. And you can look at it in other ways. If you're getting rid of a car that runs 14,000 miles a year and it gets 20 miles to the gallon,
right,
you've basically saved roughly 17 billion gallons of fuel in a year.
Okay.
That's a lot, right?
Right. Seems like it.
Sounds like a big number. Well, 17 billion gallons is really about 583 million barrels of oil per year.
Okay.
Again, sounds like a lot.
What do we use a day?
Well, in the U.S., we're using about 19 million barrels a day.
A day, okay.
So, you know, that 583 over the year is 1.6 million barrels per day. Again, roughly 8 to 10% of crude oil demand. So, you know, sometimes it's really hard for people to understand just how much oil we use and just how massive the scale is. I like to use the, you know, a measurement. I say, okay, you know, what is it? You know, in the U.S., we use roughly 20 million barrels of oil a day. And by the way, we're
20 million a day.
Yeah. Okay. We're 5% of the global population,
right,
but we use 20% of the crude oil.
Okay.
Roughly 95 to 100 million barrels every single day gets consumed in the world. Every single day. And try to picture that. 100 million barrels, if you call them a 3 foot high barrel,
right,
is 300 million feet of oil stacked on top of each other, right? Divide that by 5,000 feet or so, you have roughly 55,000 miles of oil stacked up every single day.
Wow.
And if you think about that, I mean, that would circle the Earth twice or more. It's about a quarter of the way to the moon. It's a massive amount of oil. Now, if we take, this 1.6 million barrels a day out, that's great. But you also have to remember that in the last 15, 20 years, we went from 80 million barrels a day globally to 100 million barrels a day, while the U.S. stayed flat at roughly under 20 million. So that means the rest of the world is now using 20 million barrels more than it was 15 years ago.
Right.
So we here in the U.S., if we can save 1.6 million barrels a day, that's great. But now it really depends on what happens in China and the rest of the developing world.
Sure. And it seems like China's trying to get ahead of this with a lot of the electronic vehicles that they're coming out with, different companies you see. Obviously, huge population. But you talk about a country like India or Africa has a massive population. I mean, you don't see the same sort of shift going on there. They're still using the cheaper fuels, right? Like the coals and those sort of things that are less expensive.
Yeah, and we always have to remember that as we think about, global population growth and everything else, it really kind of depends on where each of these countries in their development. The countries that want to be more like the U.S. are going to, hopefully skip over some of the steps we went through and go to a more sustainable energy mix.
Right.
But that's not guaranteed. That's very costly.
Let's get to that next. So when we come back, we're going to talk about how do you deliver this efficient, clean energy source to a individual in an efficient way, because that's really the issue, right? We talk about gas stations and what's it going to look like in the future. What does the future look like? So when we come back, we're going to talk about that. How is this going to be distributed? What does it look like? What can we expect? And where might you want to position yourself as you think about getting into this space? My guests this morning are very knowledgeable on the subject. I really appreciate them. You are listening to the Protect Your Assets Show with David Hollander, the Sandman. We'll be right back.
You can ask the Sandman questions and hear this show, Protect Your Assets, hands-free, anytime on your Amazon Echo smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, ask Protect Your Assets to play the latest podcast. Find out more at libertygroupllc.com/voice.
Now, back to Protect Your Assets with David Hollander, the Sandman.
Welcome back. I'm David Hollander, also known as the Sandman around here. That's because I help my listeners sleep well at night by answering their most troubled legal or financial questions each week. Today, we're talking about electric vehicles and natural gas energy. Are we getting this from? What does the future look like? I have two guests with me this morning who know all about the subject. Dave Anderson, who I was just talking about cars and the numbers of cars and the production and where they're coming from and what we expect. And then, of course, John Samuels. I have John on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, John. How are you?
Good morning, David. Doing great. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Good to have you both on today. So, all right. So we were just talking about EV cars and just the growth of that. Now, Dave, just assuming that the numbers are right, that we get to some more meaningful production of cars, where are they going to get energy from to power these things?
Well, it's a great question. And, the U.S. power sector is pretty, pretty well situated to actually handle the increase in electricity needed for that level of cars. It's probably less of a problem than maybe some people might make it out to be. But let's just step back and look at the sources of where we're getting our power. And talk about, where the growth would come from, assuming we need some growth here. But the U.S. generates about 4 billion kilowatts of power a year. Roughly 40% of that comes from natural gas plants. 19% comes from coal. Now, that's down from 50%. 50% of our power came from coal just 15 years ago.
So that's a good thing.
That's a great thing, yeah. Right? Natural gas has displaced coal in the U.S. power sector, while nuclear stayed pretty steady at about 20%. Wind and solar have been growing pretty tremendously, but they're still only 11% of the power generated in the United States. So, you know, natural gas emits roughly 60% less CO2 per unit of power than coal. So it's been a very good way to reduce our CO2 generation. Now, the Energy Information Administration, part of the Department of Energy, expects that wind and solar can grow over the next 8 years from about 11% to about 23%. That's a huge growth, yeah. You know, more than a double, and becoming a quarter of our capacity. But that doesn't fully displace coal.
Still solve the problem, right? Exactly.
Coal needs to go to zero if you really want a better carbon footprint. So when we get to that point, we're still looking at some coal unless you grow natural gas. Now on top of that, you need to have a little bit. You know, there's some extra growth coming from additional demand. Although I would suggest that the demand on additional electricity is probably not massive, because a lot of the electricity used for electric vehicles can be generated during periods of lower capacity utilization. So basically, nighttime, you plug your car in at nighttime. So you don't need more plants. You may need more electricity. So anyway, that's kind of where we're generating our power now. And natural gas has been a massive component of us getting better. And over the next 10 years, it's going to have to be a continued component of that.
Now, John, quick question for you. And John Samuels was the CFO, CEO of an oil company. Where are you seeing energy coming from now, particularly globally and in the U.S.? How do we fit into that, John?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it really varies depending on where you're talking about. You know, Europe has, I'd say Europe's ahead of us here in the States in terms of energy transition. You know, and then there's elsewhere in the world, emerging economies, where they just want the lowest cost fuel source. You know, so it really depends. For most of the world, coal is still the biggest source of energy and electricity. But really today, the world is getting close to 80% of its energy, its total energy for everything, from fossil fuels of varying kinds. So I think Dave's right to say, hey, not all fossil fuels are created equal. You know, if you care about climate change, you care about getting emissions down, what's the best source? It's going to come from different places. Definitely agree with the projections on wind and solar. Yeah, I don't know if that's the right number, but it's going to grow a lot, and it needs to grow a lot. But, you know, as Germany is learning the hard way this season, you know, the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow.
Right.
So, you know, what do you do during that time? And natural gas is, by comparison, a reliable, clean, and stable fuel that, you know, here in the U.S. we can find and produce very cheaply.
Yeah, talk to us about that. I mean, how does the U.S. fit into that in terms of the global supply? What percentages are we producing? What sort of supply do we have? Where I know you're actively involved in this. Where do you see energy production in the U.S. right now?
Yeah, I think it's good to narrow it down, because, you know, again, energy is very broad. And then, you know, some of the products we associate with energy, like oil and like natural gas, they're also used for other things, petrochemicals. I mean, everybody's got something in their kitchen that came from oil, you know, silicon chips and computers, et cetera. So, you know, if you want to talk oil in 2020, which obviously we all know, an anomalous year for a lot of reasons, but on the energy consumption side, people were traveling less, economies were shut in for periods of time. So the world produced about 75 million barrels of oil a day in 2020, and the U.S. Was about 12 million of that.
Hmm. And we're today in 2021. I mean, we're almost done now and going to 22. As you look around the U.S., where are you seeing productivity, say, in the oil and gas space in this country right now?
Well, there's actually only two states right now where production is growing versus declining, and that's Texas and New Mexico. New Mexico is the big standout if you were to look at a chart. Their year-over-year production growth is like 35%.
Wow.
And that is coming out of a shale play. The Delaware Basin is what it's called. And don't want to bore people on a Saturday morning with a soapbox, but it is a prolific oil and gas producer, fantastic economics. We actually just made an investment in that basin last week. So it's definitely something we like. And, you know, there's a reason that it's growing at 35%. You know, capitalism reigns, and companies are going to put their resources towards the best economics.
And then what's going on in Texas right now? I mean, we know, we've heard about, you know, Tesla moving there and a lot of folks going to Austin. And I happened to be there last week and saw the growth going on there. It's phenomenal. I mean, what is it about these two climates that's making it so robust? Is it just what's in the ground? Is it just the ability to get to it? I mean, what is it is existing? I mean, let's talk about that. You hear a lot about the government right now talking about shutting down, you know, oil production. Is that private? Is that public? I mean, what does that mean? And how does that relate to the future as you talk about energy?
Well, I mean, these are all good questions. Some of them are big questions. I mean, you know, the government was talking about shutting down oil production until it went to 80, and they were screaming for more production, you know, releasing their own in the world. You know, the biggest thing driving production growth in Texas and New Mexico is the rock. It's the geology that cannot be replicated. Now, of course, I think it's beneficial that, you know, Texas has a reputation of being, you know, very friendly for business. I don't know anything more about Tesla besides the same tweets that you read. But, you know, I think like regulation, taxes, all those things are, you know, probably contributors to why
land, right? Why cheap land.
Land, labor.
Cheaper.
You know, cost of living.
Cheaper than California.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the thing, you know, United States, which there's competition between states for businesses.
Right.
You know, I live in Denver, Colorado, and it's when I moved here 10 years ago, you know, people were flooding here, and I think they still are. I started to see billboards for other states saying, hey, come be an entrepreneur here.
Really?
I was actually in San Francisco a couple weeks ago and saw a billboard in San Francisco for, hey, move your startup to Ohio. It's cheap. So, you know, when you're running a business or you're trying to pay your bills, particularly during the pandemic, I mean, you know, I'll speak for myself, certainly made me think twice about, you know, where do I want to live and how do I want to live? You know, cost of living becomes an important thing because, you know, our time is precious and limited.
Now, let's talk about that. I mean, you know, U.S. is a big producer of natural gas and oil. How clean is our production compared to the worldwide?
Depends on who you ask. I think it's trending towards being among the cleanest barrels in the world. You know, and that's the thing is I would love to be an idealist and say, hey, well, let's just get rid of oil. Let's get rid of natural gas. Let's get rid of coal. Let's go completely renewable. I mean, that's a world I want to live in. But you got 7 billion people in the world that, you know, most of whom do not have the standard of living that we have. And they want to strive for better futures for themselves, for their kids. And they're going to do that. So when you look at forecasts, you know, total energy demand in the world is going up something like 30-40% over the next 20 years.
Wow.
And it's already, you know, this huge portion that is fossil fuel. So, you know, when you turn back to the U.S. and you look at these barrels, I mean, the U.S. oil and gas industry is not popular. Let's just be honest about that fact.
Right.
And they are fighting in their own minds for their license to operate and their very existence. So they're in the process of cleaning up their act. And in some ways, it's a shame that, you know, it didn't happen without the external pressure. But the external pressure is working. And so it is trending towards being lowest emissions per unit hydrocarbon in the world. And, you know, I don't think it's ever good to get in public and bash other countries or anything like that. But there are countries in the world that are large oil and gas producers. They do not have environmental regulations of substance that are being followed. I'll leave it at that, you know, for the sake of it Saturday morning.
Yeah, no, but I mean, you
want it coming from a regulated place.
Exactly. Coming up next, it's time for our popular They Say segment, where I'm going to ask my guests, the Omicron coronavirus is around. Is it going to cause another shutdown? And if it does, what does this mean for the price of oil? You are listening to The Sandman on the Protect Your Assets show. We'll be right back.
You can ask The Sandman questions and hear this show Protect Your Assets hands-free anytime on your Amazon Echo smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, ask Protect Your Assets to play the latest podcast. Find out more at libertygroupllc.com/voice.
Now, back to Protect Your Assets with David Hollander, The Sandman.
Welcome back. I'm David Hollander, also known as The Sandman. That's because I help my listeners sleep well at night. by answering their most troubled legal or financial questions. And if you're just joining us this morning, maybe you're worried about, should you be buying an electric vehicle right now? Seems like everybody else is. So you got two questions. One is, can you get one? And two, how will you power it? So anyways, my guests this morning are helping us answer this question. I have Dave Anderson and John Samuels, two experts in the power industry right now. Been doing this all their lives, and thank you guys both for coming in this morning. So as all of you know, it's now time for one of our fan favorite parts of the show, our They Say segment, where we debunk common myths, half-truths, and sometimes just bad advice that they say.
Who are they? What do they know that I don't? And what are they saying this week? There's only one man with all the answers, and here he is, David Hollander, the Sandman.
So here's one they say. They said this past week that Omicron virus is going to cause another shutdown, and as such, the price of oil is in trouble. Guys, what do you say?
Well, I'll let John chime in. My first indication.
Dave, you know, I feel like your insight on this is so good, Dave.
Thanks.
That's a good question. I won't punt it back to you, Dave. You're about to hand me the ball, so I'll take a shot at it. You know, it is the future, and we don't know. You know, I'll say, David, for my playbook, coronavirus really, really worried me. And about 3 or 4 months in, I read a book about the 1918 Spanish flu called Pale Rider. And it's beyond the scope of this conversation. I don't want to get on too much of a tangent, but really 1918, which is when the flu, as we know it, still here today, first emerged. And it was pretty bad, pretty deadly. It lasted 3 seasons, and we're kind of going into our 3rd season. So, is this new variant bad? Probably, maybe. It's not going to be the last variant. But, we're also going into a winter flu season where it's going to come up anyway. So I think in this category, I'm an optimist. I'm sure there's going to be some bad news headlines. But I think pretty critical to my view on that is a week or two ago, OPEC, which is a group of oil-producing nations around the world that does not include the U.S., got together with their meeting to decide what they're going to do with production. And this is coming on the heels of the U.S. Not only talking down oil, but also releasing crude oil from our strategic reserves. And they chose to not make any changes. So, those groups are in possession of some of the best data you can have out there. And I think if they were really worried about it, they would have cut production. Look, there's variation, there's seasonality, all these things. I personally don't think that it's going to be the death knell for anything over the coming months. And I think that the world will beat coronavirus one way or another, just like it beat the flu. And I think some of what we've achieved over the last year fighting this has been quite impressive. So I'm an optimist.
Good. All right. Well, let's also shift to something that I think is a big byproduct of what we're talking about this morning. It's natural gas in the U.S. So, guys, let's talk about that. I mean, the amount of natural gas consumed in the U.S. and the price of gas. Let's talk about that. Right now, the price of gas in the U.S. is around $4. You talk about Europe. I mean, what are they spending on a cubic foot of gas in Germany right now?
Well, that price has skyrocketed, David. If you're following the news, it's well over $30 per MCF or per
30.
Yeah, which is four times what we're looking at here. And there's a lot of reason for that. I mean, natural gas growth in places like China. China's growth in the last 20 years is 1,300% growth in natural gas. There's a lot of competition for global natural gas coming from places like Russia or through LNG, liquefied natural gas markets. So if you're not producing your own natural gas locally, it's very difficult to move. It doesn't move around the world.
How do you move? I mean, how do you move it? How would I move natural gas from the U.S. to, say, England?
Well, you have to liquefy it. I mean, natural gas moves around this country via pipelines. And to move it elsewhere, you have to liquefy
it. Like to go across an ocean.
Yep. It becomes, super cooled and liquefied, and that takes a multi-billion-dollar plant just to move a little bit of it.
And so you have to have the plant built.
you know, build the plant, and you got to build a plant on the other side to deliquefy it and gasify it and then move it around. So it is not an easily transportable product, which means it can really be subject to dislocations of supply and demand, which is what Europe is dealing with. And it's really what the U.S. has attempted to avoid through its policies and through the actions of private companies over the last 20 years. I mean, natural gas in the U.S. Has grown roughly 50% in the last 19 years.
Why is that?
Well, part of it's technology. I mean, it's really, you know, John mentioned the shale plays in places like Texas and Louisiana and up in the Marcellus and the Utica up in the eastern area. So natural gas.
Now, when you say that, I mean, I love how you guys talk about these areas. Just for everybody listening, these are areas in the country, right, within these states that have names associated with them where production's occurring. Is that what you guys are referring to?
Sorry to get down.
Where's a Utica? I don't know about Utica.
Sorry, these are areas, but basically it's Texas, Louisiana, New Mexico, North Dakota, places like that, as well as Pennsylvania.
It's just hard for us Californians to kind of relate to some of these places in some respects.
There's a lot of this country that's doing its part effectively to power us. And California, you know, chooses, you know, not to produce, and that's perfectly within the right to do so. But other parts of the country are you know, doing what they have to do. Mm-hmm. So natural gas is pretty much all. Everything we consume here is produced here. There's a little bit of import, a little bit of export, but for the most part, it's produced here.
In the U.S.
Here in the U.S., in the continental U.S. Right. And a significant portion of it is associated gas. Some natural gas comes out of wells specifically targeting natural gas formations. Others come along with crude oil. It gets produced as a byproduct of crude oil. So to the extent you were going to reduce crude oil drilling, you would also reduce natural gas. Now, remember, natural gas is not just used in power production. We talked about that. It's a big portion of it. But as John mentioned, it also heats your home. It
dries my clothes.
It dries your clothes. it produces hot water. You cook on it.
So, I do. I used to cook. I love to cook on natural gas.
Yeah. So, you know, it's the biggest growth has been in the power sector. But what's interesting is we've become very good at drilling for oil and gas. Just 15 years ago, less than 15 years ago, we had over 1,600 drilling rigs working in the United States drilling for oil and gas. And today we've got about 400, a little less than 500.
Wow.
So we're producing double the amount of natural gas we were producing not long ago.
Wow.
So we're getting more efficient. We're getting better.
Is that because of technology and regulation? Is that essentially what's going on?
It's technology, right? We used to drill a lot of vertical wells, and without getting too technical, we drill horizontal wells and we fractionate, right? We frack wells. And so we've displaced a lot of the old technology with new technology that really, one, makes oil and gas drilling much more effective. That is, you're not drilling dry holes. And number two, much more efficient.
You're getting a lot more out of it than
you're getting
used
10
to.
Times more out of an individual well, maybe 20 times or 30 times more than you did just 20 years ago.
Wow.
And that's a huge, huge impact. And that's why we've had low natural gas prices.
I'm going to ask the question because I'm thinking in my head, I've just been seeing so much of it. That process is the byproduct of that environmentally destructive in the way that, say, coal is in the environment. Right, because you hear a lot about that. Is that true, John?
Coal is. I really have a bias against coal. If I'm just going to probably just get that out there to the listeners, so they're not wondering. You know, coal is really the biggest driver of climate change from an emission standpoint when you look around the world.
Right, and that is the issue. So, I mean, let's talk about it. The main issue right now that I think most of us are facing. Certainly, you know, my kids are concerned about it. Is, you know, what are you doing to my world, my breathing ability, global warming, ice melting on both poles? I mean, all this sort of stuff that's being driven by pollution in the environment, right? In the air, is that right?
100%.
Okay. So
rising CO2 concentrations are making the planet warmer. That's driving climate change. I mean, that's not the only thing 7 billion humans are doing to it, but that's the climate change. Absolutely.
Okay. So the biggest contributor to that is coal.
Absolutely.
Okay. So what I'm hearing you guys say is that the increased ability for us to say develop natural gas, which is certainly something that we all agree we use, Is that going to go anywhere, as you guys see it, in the next 20 years, the use of natural gas?
In my opinion, natural gas use is going up. And, you know, my opinion is informed by smarter people with better data that have forecasts. I mean, if you were to go out and look at the big groups that do forecasting, David, like 20 years out, I mean, first of all, that's just a hard task. Like, you're going to be wrong. It's just who's the least wrong.
Okay.
But, you know, you have the International Energy Administration. I think of it like the UN of energy. It's internationally funded and, you know, meant to drive world consensus. You have the U.S. version of that. You have various private groups. You know, really, in all of them, natural gas demand globally is going up for the next 10 years. And then some say it's going to continue to go up. Some say it'll go down. But, you know, when you want to talk about the emissions impact of that, it's not just natural gas versus coal. I mean, coal is going to be dirty without carbon capture. And I think that's actually a big direction the world is going to go to solve this problem. And we will solve this problem. I mean, humans, we can do a lot given time and we put our minds to something. But it's which natural gas fields are you producing from and what are your methods? Because what environmentalists rightly get on when they are against natural gas is leaks and flaring and other operational practices that allow natural gas to escape into the environment. When it is vented or released, it's really destructive. Now, again, you have to compare it because we need energy. You know, the U.S. consumes more energy per capita than any country in the world. And we need energy, and we can't tell the world what to do. So natural gas, in my mind, is hands down a cleaner fuel. But, you know, we've got to produce it the right way. You know, and that means good laws on methane release, flaring, and all these other things. And that stuff is underway in the U.S., and that's one of the reasons why you don't need to like natural gas. You can say, what is the best fuel choice? What is the most affordable, reliable, and the cleanest? Because there's no such thing as zero. I mean, producing a solar panel and shipping it has emissions.
Sure.
But when you look at coal and natural gas on those two things, natural gas is the clear winner. U.S. emissions from power generation have been going down for the last decade in an absolute sense. And that is the shift that Dave talked about, from coal to natural gas, whereas in other parts of the world, emerging economies, China, India, their economies are growing rapidly, as are their emissions, and they need fuel. So I know that's covering a lot of ground there.
But, no, it's perfect.
I think natural gas has a bright future.
Yeah. Okay. So you've been listening to the Protect Your Assets show with David Hollander. When we come back, we're going to be talking about opportunities that exist in this space. With my guests this morning. There's so much more to come, so keep it right here. We'll be right back.
You can ask the Sandman questions and hear this show Protect Your Assets hands-free anytime on your Amazon Echo smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, ask Protect Your Assets to play the latest podcast. Find out more at libertygroupllc.com/voice.
Now back to Protect Your Assets with David Hollander, the Sandman.
We're back. I'm David Hollander, also known as the Sandman. And we've been talking about energy. And what's it going to look like over the next 10, 15, 20 years? My guests this morning are experts in this area, been doing this most of their lives, and they certainly know where it's happening right now. So previously, we've been talking about EVs, natural gas, the drilling efficiency in this country where it's happening. But I'd like to switch now to opportunities in oil and gas and energy, frankly, and what it looks like over the next 10 to 15 years. A lot of people that I talk about 100% solar and wind. So if we could get ourselves to no oil, 100% solar and wind, guys, what's the problem with that, and is that possible?
Well, I'm glad you asked that one, David. If you could get to that theoretically, that point where you were in the grid, it's all solar, all wind, a component of nuclear, some geothermal. You know, the issue still is that there are points when the wind isn't blowing and the sun's not shining. So you either need to store that energy or you need to have some backup for it. And storage is not yet where, you know, we're not there
at all, right? And that's this lithium problem and making big enough batteries, enough batteries. It's just not possible, as far as I understand it.
There are a lot of ways to store energy. Batteries, you know, batteries is a sort of generic term, but yeah, many, many different battery technologies. But it would be a massive build out to be able to have that kind of storage. And right now, you know, the best way to offset the intermittent variability of a solar plant or a wind plant is a natural gas plant. It's one of the few power plants that you can turn on and off quickly. You can't do that for a coal plant. You definitely can't do that for a nuclear plant.
Right.
So natural gas, as we've been harping on a little bit, I think is a key component, no matter what your view of the future is.
All right. Now, so, John, quick question. John, if natural gas is here to stay, talk to us right now, if you can, quickly about the economics of today drilling an oil and gas well. And where is that happening, and what are we talking about in terms of cost? Are you there, John? I guess I lost John.
Hey,
there he is.
I was talking to a muted line. I'm not.
All right, well, we got you.
That's what you get for bringing me on the radio.
Go for it. Go for it.
No, if you want to talk about natural gas economics, you know, let's narrow that down.
Drilling a well, yeah. Just producing that.
Yeah,
now.
Drilling a well. Let's just say onshore, you know, lower 48 in the U.S. Let's talk about Louisiana as an example. You have a play out there. It's called the Haynesville. That's the name of a rock formation. People drill wells. They spend $10 million on a well. And it depends on a couple different factors, but they're going to get 100% of their money back in about a year to a year and a half.
All right, stop right there. I mean, that is from an economic standpoint, incredible. All right, it's just incredible. So why is that? Why is that efficiency occurring today?
It really just comes down again to the geology and the technology that Dave spoke about. When you go in and complete these wells, it is like shaking up a bottle of champagne and pulling that cork. And if you haven't done it, you've seen it, you know what that's like. That's exactly what it is. So you get this big, what's called flush production, and you get a lot of your money back, and the economics are really good.
All right.
Get similar payouts in New Mexico and other places as well.
Perfect. So,
And again, this is an asset that will produce for 30 years. So you got all your money back quickly, and your production is going to be lower. But over the life of these wells, you know, that $10 million well might generate $50 million of total cash flow for the operator. And they got $10, $12 million of that back in the first year.
Wow. So, all right.
You know, I have enough experience with government bond yields to know that that's good economics.
I want to give a big thanks to Dave Anderson, John Samuels, for being on with me this morning. Great show. Thanks, guys. As always, we appreciate it. Want to give a big thanks to the team for putting together a great show today. Because without my team, I'm just another pretty voice on the radio. Go out and make the rest of your life the best of your life.
Investment advisory services are offered through Liberty Wealth Management, a registered investment advisor. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. The strategies mentioned are not suitable for everyone. The information expressed does not consider your specific situation or objectives and may not be appropriate for all investors. Past performance is not indicative of future results. To better understand the risk associated with investing and how it reacts to different market conditions, listeners should always consult with their qualified investment professionals, financial advisors, legal or tax specialists, and conduct their due diligence before making any financial decisions or taking any action. The legal information provided on the air is not intended to substitute for callers hiring their lawyers to advise them about personal legal matters. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Liberty Group LLC paid for the following program, and the host's views and opinions do not represent those of the station or its ownership. California Life Agent number 048569. KNBR and Liberty are not affiliated. Persons engaging the services of one affiliate of Liberty Group LLC companies should be aware that each company is operated separately. You're listening to the Protect Your Assets Radio Network.